It's funny, right? The little things that stick out in your memory. Like the stuff that's, why is this even in my head? But then you start to maybe understand why it's in your head years later. Like this moment. I was 18 or 19, I think. I'm home, it's summer, I'm at my parents' house. I have no idea what I'm gonna do in my life, and I am just watching an ungodly amount of TV. And one night, I'm watching people cook on TV, which was kind of weird. This was the mid-90s. But anyway, one of the women on the screen is chopping garlic, and she goes, "Now, you really wanna find some good, fresh garlic. When it's really fresh, it's almost wet when you cut it." And that's it. That random moment has stuck with me forever. But 2 years later, I got my first cooking job, and that changed my life. Okay, so it probably wasn't just because of that garlic moment on TV, but every time I think of Mary Sue Milliken and Susan Feniger, the chefs who were cooking on my TV that day, I think about how many people there were like me, sitting in front of their TVs and seeing for the first time these two make cooking seem so fun. Now, Mary Sue and Susan are way more than just TV chefs. They've been in business together for almost 40 years. They opened a quirky little restaurant called City Cafe that helped to redefine the restaurant scene in Los Angeles. Today, they have a wildly popular group of Mexican restaurants called Border Grill, and they're active philanthropists. And this year, they're also the winners of the Julia Child Award. It's given every year at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History by the Julia Child Foundation, and it celebrates the people who've helped to change American food culture. And they're here with me today. So Mary Sue and Susan, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be here.
Thank you. We're excited to be here.
It's a great moment. Congratulations so much on winning the Julia Child Award. So actually, before I start, did you guys know Julia Child?
Oh my gosh. We knew her so well and loved her so much. This is just a crazy, amazing honor for us.
Yeah, she came into City Cafe the first time, I think, in 1982, and we were just beside ourselves, you know, excited that we were going to be cooking for Julia Child.
Wait, you have to tell how she came. We were in our tiny little kitchen that was like 8 by 10 or 10 by 10 or something like that, and we had, the bathroom was in the kitchen, and there was, you know, we had finally put a stove in the kitchen with an oven, which we hadn't had before. Before, we had just had two hot plates and two hibachis in the parking lot out back. But there was a double-door refrigerator right in front of the bathroom. I think Mary Sue was behind the stove, and there were pots and pans all hanging. And I think I was on the floor cleaning out the refrigerator in front of the bathroom. So that, all of a sudden, we hear someone come in because guests came into the kitchen to go to the bathroom. And someone knocked their head on the pots and pans and said hello in her, you know, voice that you can't not recognize. And there I was with food on the floor. Mary Sue was cooking, and it was her. Because we didn't know she was coming in.
No, it was a big surprise. It was so much fun, though. And, you know, she was one of those people who was a big champion of young, up-and-coming women and, you know, anyone who had a passion for food. You know, she just connected to immediately. So it was really fun.
It was amazing. I mean, that was, you know, what year was it, Mill? 82? 82. So that was really, we had just opened our first place. It had been just a year that we'd been open. So it was very new of being, you know, entrepreneurs and young chefs. So to have her come in was really like, okay, you couldn't get any bigger than that. So that was very exciting.
It's like being visited by the Pope, right?
Right.
So now you have this award. And I think the criteria for the award is, quote, people who have made a profound and significant difference in the way America cooks, eats, and drinks. So that seems like a big deal. And it sounds kind of like a Lifetime Achievement Award. So do you feel like you're in the Lifetime Achievement Award phase of your careers?
Yeah, that's so interesting you say that. I think, you know, I think we both take it as the half Lifetime Achievement Award since there's two of us.
And we, you know, we both still act like we're between 16 and 20.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's sort of our secret for how we stay young, because we both, you know, are still so in love with this career. It couldn't have worked out better for either of us.
And and you have, I mean, I think the career keeps you so young, or can, because you also have, you know, kids that are between like 18 and, you know, 30 that are working for you. 30 is even old.
Sure.
Working for us. So, you know, we have so many young kids working with us. And I think that just by its nature keeps you young. And, you know, and I think we're immersed in it with them. And so just the nature of it. And also, all we've also always been very hungry for learning and growing. And even way back when we first started, you know, teaching cooking classes, you know, even though we, I think we probably knew a fair amount, we would like study every ingredient so we would know every detail or a lot of details about a tomato, an onion, you know, broccoli. And
I think there were there was a fear that there would be one moment of silence during a cooking class. So even, and you know, that never happens with us because there's two of us for one, and one of us really talks a lot.
What?
And then
who?
There's you. I think that was really what made us, you know, we did so many cooking classes before our first radio show, Good Food, and that really had prepared us for, you know, finishing each other's sentences and building on each other's thoughts and kind of articulating our philosophy about food out loud. And that is a really important, I think, part of anyone's career, anyone's, you know, profession, because you, I think it really helps you to, when you're teaching, it helps you to, you know, be grounded in what you really believe.
And, you know, so much, I think, back then was based around the French kitchen. And so both of us, through culinary school and then through working in great restaurants, which were all French restaurants at the time.
And in France, and working in France.
Right. We both worked a year, Mary Sue in Paris and myself in the south of France. And I think that training gave us technique and skills that I think was really the backbone of us being able to then explore other cuisines, or at least that's how it felt to us, is that there was such a great strong background in the French kitchen that then when we were able to explore other cuisines, we were able to take them apart in ways that I don't know that we could have if we didn't have that training.
This is super interesting because I want to get to your cooking. Because I think you're known as, you know, like I, when I was growing up, I first heard of you through your TV show, Two Hot Tamales. And I was like, oh, okay, they cook
Mexican
food.
Don't act like you're so young, Francis. And we're so old.
So
wow.
When well, I was in utero, my mom would put the headphones on your show.
Right.
No, but like, no, when I was, you know, I, what that show was 1995? 93?
Yeah, was it? Yeah, it was right when Food Network began.
And but anyway, my point is I thought of you as being chefs who cook Mexican food, and certainly you have Border Grill, which is your family of restaurants. But I want to go back a bit to, say, 1981. You're opening your first restaurant, City Cafe. Like you said, you don't have a stove in the kitchen. You're cooking practically in the parking lot and running the food inside.
No. Not practically. We had two hibachis on the ground in the parking lot where many of the customers park.
But we only use them at night.
Yeah, we only used them at nighttime.
The daytime, it was more sandwiches, salads, soups.
So you're literally cooking in the, you know, it's this very, you know, it sounds like this very buyer bootstraps kind of place. And you gained a following because you weren't cooking French cooking. You were cooking this really internationally inspired food. So it's interesting to hear you had classical French training. What inspired you to start taking in all these other influences? And this was 81, right? So this is not common at the time in quote-unquote chefy restaurants.
Yeah, not at all. It was actually, you know, there was Ma Maison. There, Espago opened in 81 also.
No.
Yeah, it did.
Oh, yeah, Spago opened in 81. That's right.
Yeah, but so there was a little bit of a kind of a thrust towards more, you know, casual but modern and really exciting food with Wolfgang's Spago. But
our, beyond that, there was Chasen's, you know, Morton's, Valentino.
Not very many restaurants that were pushing the envelope.
Yeah, and La Rangerie.
We decided to pretty much follow our hearts. You know, we had a tiny restaurant with 8 tables and 9 stools at the bar, and we cooked whatever we loved. But the first couple of years, there was a lot of rustic sort of country French food, because that's what we were drawn to, much more than the nouvelle cuisine and the fancy hot cuisine.
We had, Mary Sue and I had met at Le Perroquet in Chicago, and he was doing very cutting-edge dishes then. You know, Jovan Trbojevic was just an amazing restaurateur. So we were doing things like taking whole baby lambs and stuffing those and then poaching all the different components of it. And when we both came back from being in France and we decided to open up our first little place, the menu was made up of things like cassoulet, pot-au-feu, confit à duck, so all country French stuff, really not anything.
But we also did things like pasta salads and you know, sandwiches and things that were very, you know, it was a cafe. It was open from 8 in the morning till 10 at night. So it wasn't anything like, you know, any of the fancy restaurants we'd been trained in. So we had to also kind of dig and figure out, well, what let's make Susan's mother's coleslaw or her pickles, or let's make, you know, German potato salad that my mom made. And we would do that. But then after about 2 years, neither of us had had a break more than one day a week for ages. And Susan decided that she was going to take a trip and go to India. And I'll never forget it. The night before she left, we were having a little kind of like a fake fight.
We were racing. We were racing to see who could bone a leg of lamb quicker.
And then that's how your fights work out? Like,
yeah, I think I won.
She did win because I like threw my arm up in the air as in a gesture, and she had her knife in the air, and I cut the tendon in my finger. So I had to go to the hospital and get a cast, and she was like, God. Oh, maybe I can't go. And I said, no, you got to go. You got to go. And so then there was me and Jose Luis, and we were cooking everything for those 2 weeks while she was gone. But what happened is when she came home, she was gung-ho to put about, you know, 4 or 5 Indian dishes on the menu. We did pakoras, like little vegetable fritters. We did a puna pancake. We made dal and curry and did
chutney and raita. And
it was really like immediately we just incorporated it into the menu. So it was all these rustic French things and a bunch of Indian things.
Yeah. So that and I had been so inspired over there by all the flavor profiles and just it was such an interesting cuisine. All vegetarian was the place where I was staying, on an ashram where a friend of mine lived. So I spent the whole time in the kitchen with his cooks. And although women were, you know, not allowed in the main little kitchen, that basically were just 3 holes in a cement block that, you know, you put a fire underneath it. But all the women were out on the porch grinding spices, making all the different breads. And it was so inspiring that it just was something I felt like we have to put these things on the menu. Mm. And then about a year later, Mary Sue took her first trip. She didn't cut me right before she left, but she took her first trip then to Thailand and had a very similar experience.
Yeah, my uncle was there, and he lined it up so I could work in the kitchen of the hotel where he was, and it had a big, very, very authentic Thai buffet, and the woman who cooked it was actually the cook for the King and Queen of Thailand for 10 years before that.
Oh, wow.
And she didn't speak any English, and I didn't speak any Thai, but, you know, we got along immediately, and we cooked together all day, every day for 3 weeks, and then same thing, I came home, and we were, you know, Thai melon salad, and Chinese sausage salad and Thai red curry duck and scallops. And oh my gosh, we have pictures that are just amazing.
And so then, you know, then our menu then had cassoulet and then duck red curry and then potato budgie with mint cilantro chutney and then, you know, pot-au-feu. And so it was very mixed like that.
And then one day the rigatoni that we bought from a person who made fresh pasta and delivered it came, and it was like 3 or 4 inches long instead of the normal 1.5 inches. And we were like, what happened? They said, oh, we had a problem with the cutter and blah, 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 blah. And then this is how Susan and I kind of worked together. We're in the kitchen going, oh, you remember those chicken breasts? We got to use them today no matter what. We can't let them go another day. Okay, well, let's make a sausage out of that chicken breast with a lot of fennel, and we'll stuff it into the rigatoni. And then, I don't know, what do you think? Well, let's just try it with cream and Parmesan. And Anyway, that rigatoni became like a signature dish that everybody ordered. And so we had to tell the pasta company, can you make our rigatoni long all the time?
And literally, it became one of those favorite dishes. And some of the inspiration comes that way of trying to like get rid of things that we think we need to get rid of. And other inspiration comes from people that work for us, that someone whose mother made something when they were growing up in a tiny town in Mexico, like our mushroom empanadas.
Or you see something in the market. I mean, when we first decided to turn City Cafe into a little tiny Mexican restaurant called Border Grill, we went to Mexico for 3 weeks. We drove around in a little tiny VW bug and we, you know, asked a trillion questions of everybody we could find. But if we'd go to the market and see something we'd never seen before, we would buy it. And then we would take it and ask people what it is, how do you use it, what's this chili that... I remember we discovered Chipotle chilies, and nobody knew what a Chipotle was, more or less a chain of restaurants. It was 1985.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we didn't, you know, that first trip to Mexico, we stayed... Well, our little kitchen at City Cafe was myself and Mary Sue and a dishwasher. But then eventually... We hired like a culinary student who came in, you know, probably wanted like $18 an hour. We said, no, we'll hire you for like $5 an hour, whatever it was at that time.
Whatever minimum wage
yeah.
was. And so, he said, okay.
So he came to work for us. His name was Tacho, and we loved him. And we ended up going to Mexico City and staying with his parents in their home. And his mom took us every day for a few days to the market. This was our first trip, and we like bought everything that we didn't know what it was and come home and cook with her all day. So it was how we started to learn about Mexican ingredients. And we fell in love with this cuisine. And then we did this driving around where we just like ate everything. We wrote our first menu in the Volkswagen Bug. When we came back, we opened up. And when we opened up with this, you know, Mexican menu, and literally we had to take our notebook out, like with the panuchos or with the gorditas. We couldn't remember what they even were,
yeah.
you know, called. And so we were constantly looking at our notebook. But that was sort of the beginning of Border Grill. That was the beginning.
Wow. Again, I keep thinking about the time frame. This is in the early to mid 80s. This is not stuff that was happening in chefy restaurants. And, you know, people starting today have such a different frame of reference than that. And I think they probably grew up with, you know, their favorite Thai restaurant that they went to, you know, with their family and their favorite Mexican place that they went to and all that stuff. So all that stuff is already built into so many American palates as they're growing up now.
Right. You know, when we opened City, so the bigger version, when we opened City Restaurant, and it was then food that was influenced from cities all around the world, we put a tandoori oven in, and we got that tandoori oven from a owner of a hotel. He was an Indian man. We went downtown in a pickup truck and picked up this unfired tandoori oven. So it's just raw clay that's been dried, and it's like held together with elephant hair. And we brought it back in the back of a pickup truck, hoping we wouldn't hit too big a bump so that it would crack. And then we learned all about how to fire it. And then we spent one day, like 14 hours, where you have to bring it up to like 1,200 degrees. We wrapped our bodies so we could stick our arms in there because you had to keep brushing the sides with a brown sugar and mustard oil in order to glaze it. Hmm. We played Indian music and incense. And then finally, you know, the night before our opening party, and Ruth Reichel was there that night, and Wolf. We that night, like at 3 a.m, we finally made our first batch of naan. Uh-huh. And you can't even, it looked like a dirty sock when we pulled it out of the oven.
Well, interestingly, you talk about how different it is these days for young cooks. I mean, we had never gone through an opening.
Right.
We didn't know what that meant. You know, an opening, it was just completely seat of the pants, like, and we were dead out of money. We had to open because we needed some cash. We couldn't even buy groceries. So we had been in the kitchen with our health department, the okay, for about maybe 48 hours when we opened the doors and we were flooded with people. And we were the only two people who knew how to cook the food.
Oh. And that very first night, our hood, you know, we had to go through all getting the approvals of the tandoori oven because no one even knew how to give it approval. We finally got it approved. So we opened the door and the hoods went out that first night. And so it was crazy hot on the line. I almost passed out. And we were jammed. And right, Mary Sue and I were the only two that were like running from station to station.
I'm so happy we know now what we know because, you know, that opening was pretty brutal. But, you know, I think also what's different is we were two young women and I think subconsciously we felt like, yeah, we could go work for some more French guys or work in French kitchens here and, you know, really work our way up. But how long would it take us to call the shots for our own business? Neither of us, I think, were very excited about working for someone. It seemed like a better gamble to, even if you had to go super small like we did, to open and be our own bosses.
Okay, so a number of years after that, you get a call to go on the Food Network. What was that like? Because that was a new frontier.
Yeah, it was. We had gotten called to come and do Chef for a Day, I think. It was a 5-day stint to come on and do it.
Well, you taped 5 shows in one day.
Yeah. Well, that was normal. That was actually less than when we started Two Hot Tamales.
And then, you know, we went and we did our 5 shows and we had a really good time. We were just joking around all day. And, you know, by this time we were pretty comfortable. We'd already had our radio show for 3 or 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was definitely kind of... you know, I think teaching a lot of classes prepared us for radio. The radio prepared us for television. Radio is harder, in my opinion, than TV because you don't have the visual. You have to really create something, you know, that people can conjure up in their minds. But I think that they immediately thought to themselves, because they came back to us like literally the next week and said, would you do 60 Mexican-inspired TV shows called Cooking South of the Border, cha-cha-cha, or whatever.
Yeah, we're like, no, we'll do the TV shows, but we're not going to call it that.
So I think it was your mother who came up with Two Hot Tamales.
Maybe. We kept coming up with different names, but we came up with Two Hot Tamales, and they went for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, we were both, I think because, like Mary Sue said, we were so comfortable with information because it was so much a part of our everyday life because we always thought of ourselves as teachers to the people with the people that work for us, that we just did the same thing and we were just ourselves. So we weren't nervous in front of the camera. So that was really made TV very easy for us. We treated it as though we were teaching a class, you know, with 50 people in front of us.
And in those days, you know, Rhys Schoenfeld and his wife, they had sort of started the network based on, he had started CNN and his idea was that every bit of programming ought to be fresh. So, you know, it's food every day. You shoot something, you play it, and then that's it. You don't play it again, or you play it 3 times a day at different times. And it was just very, you know, it was the wild, wild west. They didn't know what they were doing. Yeah. I don't think.
Yeah, we shot 6 shows a day, 5 days a week. So in 1 week, we shot 30 shows.
And then we went and prepared all the recipes and everything. And so that was a lot of pre-production work that we would do. We'd get the recipes together, the talking notes, you know, things that we wanted to make sure we didn't forget to let our audience know. And then we'd come back like a month later and do another 30 shows.
Wow.
But they were quick, though. You know, they'd roll camera and then they wouldn't say cut until you were 25 minutes in. And then they never edited it at all.
Right. I mean, they would say, you know, they would be showing us like the countdown, cut, cut. And I think we sort of ignored it a lot of the time.
Susan always ignored it.
I ignored it. And then it was like, okay, we got to go. So it was.
The chicken's still raw, but see you next time.
Yeah. it was pretty fun. And we almost thought we were on vacation because we were used to working, you know, from 7 in the morning till 11 at night, you know, 6 days a week.
Yeah, and in the studio, we'd be getting off, start at 7 and get off at 6.
And we'd be like, oh my God, we've got the whole night to go out in New York and eat and drink. And yeah.
But okay, so like 4 years, I think the show ran, Two Hot Tamales ran. So and then were hundreds and hundreds of episodes. You've had many restaurants through the years. And Susan, you actually had restaurants apart from Mary Sue as well. But together, you've been a business partnership for 38 years?
Is it 8?
I think so.
Is it 8 now? 38?
Yeah, I'm like 5 years into my marriage. It feels like it's the only thing I've ever known. Like, how have you kept it together? And did it feel like you were inevitably going to be together for 38 years plus?
I think it did for me anyway. It was when I met Susan, we were the only two women. I was the first and she was the second at Le Perroquet. And I had never met anyone that I was so comfortable with just to cook with. It was just really very automatic and easy. But then, you know, she went her way and I went my way and I didn't really think about it, or there was no conscious decision. But after kind of keeping in touch when we ended up in France around the same time, kind of serendipitously, that was when we had a couple bottles of wine and looked out the window and there was a rainbow. And we said, okay, let's open a restaurant together. And, you know, I remember, I got to find that notebook because it had like names of restaurants like Mademoiselles. Really goofy. Like we didn't have any money or anything. But then, you know, I think over the years, it's been a real sometimes challenge and a real joy. I think the times that I appreciate Susan the most is when we've gone through a failure or we're failing, because failing together is so much more fun than failing by yourself. You can imagine. And of course, there's plenty of ups and downs. And we've always, I think, been really sensitive to each other's needs. You know, I've got two kids and Susan's, you know, got her partner of a long time, but basically, you know, we're different people and we have different needs. So it can't always be the same. It has to change. Our partnership has to change.
And I think we both, probably through each of our individual therapy, you know, took responsibility for, you know, where we were at in our lives and what we wanted. And I think that helped because we were willing to be flexible. So we allowed that openness to happen. And so I think that's what helped us be able to stay great partners. And there's something so amazing about having a partner who you trust impeccably. You know, it doesn't mean we don't disagree or that we're always on the same page, because we definitely aren't.
And sometimes we might not even completely trust each other. I know you think we do, but there's times when...
Huh, I mean, this is brand new, Francis. Thank you for being our therapist.
When
here.
We argue about things, it's definitely like, you know, I don't trust that point of view. Anyway,
oh, yeah.
You know.
I think there's things like, I know that no matter what, like if something were to go down, that we would both be there to take care of it. You know, we pull together in a really strong way.
And we must have, you know, intuitively known that our skill sets were different enough that we would complement each other a lot and be able to kind of fill in the blanks, which is a good thing and a bad thing because, you know, I never really have had to develop certain skills because Susan would always take care of that. Like, you know, coddling and babysitting the employees. I didn't have to do that. But, you know, so I think as we've matured, we've both gotten better at doing what the other does also to just become more of a well-rounded sort of individual.
Yeah.
Because I think in the beginning we were very, you know, we had real separate. I love pastries. I like order. I like things to work. I like things to happen and to flow in the way that they should. Susan adores the hotline, the chaos. She loves a problem. She loves everything falling apart. So it's just, you know, we're lucky that we have those complementary skill sets.
Yeah. It's like this is such a cheesy analogy. I'm going to hate myself for saying this, but like you're like the steel for each other's knives. You're different things, but you sharpen each other. What a gift. To have this partnership, this friendship, and congratulations.
That's not cheesy. I like that.
Yeah.
The steel for each other's knives. I think that's brilliant.
That's all I kept thinking of when you kept saying, like, oh, like, we're different, but we have to learn to do each other's things. And I just think, like, oh, you sharpen yourselves against one another. And I think that's such a key to a creative partnership.
Yeah.
So congratulations again on the award, on 38 years together in business. May it be many, many more. And it was great to talk with you.
Thank you so much.
Great to be here, Francis.
We'll have to get back together with you on the next Half Lifetime Achievement Award if we get that again.
You're the best.
Terrific. Thank you guys so much.
All right. Thanks.
That was the duo of Mary Sue Milliken and Susan Feniger, the 2018 winners of the Julia Child Award.